Chapter 39. Painted in a charcoal gray with no markings but a small American Stars and Stripes flag on the vertical stabilizer, the McDonnell Douglas C-17 soared above an ocean of pearl-white clouds blanketing the glaring ice of Antarctica like a giant, featherless pterodactyl over a Mesozoic landscape. Air Force Captain Lyle Stafford was quite at home in his cockpit office, flying over the frozen continent. Normally, he flew back and forth between Christchurch, New Zealand, and the American ice stations scattered around Antarctica, transporting scientists, equipment, and supplies. This trip, they had been abruptly pressed into service to fly the hurriedly assembled assault teams to the Ross Ice Shelf and drop them over the Destiny Enterprises mining facility. Stafford looked more like a public relations director than a pilot. Graying hair neatly trimmed, always ready with a smile, he was always volunteering to help out Air Force service and charity organizations. On most flights, he read a book, while his co-pilot, Lieutenant Robert Brannan, a long-boned Californian whose knees came halfway to his chin, tended the controls and instruments. Almost reluctantly, he glanced from his book, The Einstein Papers by Craig Durgo, out his side window, and then at the global positioning systems display. "Time to go back to work," he announced, putting aside the book. He turned and smiled at Major Tom Cleary, who sat perched on a stool behind the pilots. "It's almost time to begin pre-breathing, Major, and acclimate yourselves to the oxygen." Cleary stared through the windshield over the pilots' heads, but all he saw was cloud cover. He assumed that a corner of the Ross Ice Shelf was looming unseen ahead and below the aircraft. "How's my time?" Stafford nodded at the instrument panel. "We'll be over your release point in 1 hour. Are your men ready and eager?" "Ready, maybe, but I'd hardly describe them as eager. They've all jumped from a jet aircraft at 35,000 feet at one time or another, but not while it was traveling at 400 miles an hour. We're used to feeling the aircraft slow down before the ramp lowers." "Sorry I can't bring you in closer, slower and lower," said Stafford sympathetically. "The trick is for you and your men to land on the ice without your chutes being discovered in the air. My orders state in no uncertain terms for me to make my routine supply run to McMurdo Sound in my normal flight pattern. I've shaved it as close as I dare without raising suspicion. As it is, you'll have to glide nearly 10 miles to your target zone just outside the security fences." "The wind is blowing from the sea, so that's in your favor," offered Brannan.
"The cloud cover helps, too," Cleary said slowly.
"If they have a functioning radar system, the operator will have to have 4 eyes to detect us from the exact moment we exit until we deploy our canopies." Stafford made a slight course change and then said, "I don't envy you, Major, jumping from a nice, warm airplane into an icy blast 100 degrees below zero." Cleary smiled. "At least you didn't hand me the tired old pilot's line about jumping from a perfectly good airplane. I appreciate that." They all laughed for a few moments at the inside joke among professionals. For decades, parachutists had been posed the question, "Why do you jump from a perfectly good airplane?" usually by pilots. The stock answer Cleary usually gave was, "When a perfectly good airplane exists, then I'll quit jumping." "As for the cold," Cleary continued, "our electrically heated thermal suits will keep us from turning into icicles while we descend to a warmer altitude." "The clouds extend, too, within 1,000 feet of the ground, so you'll be falling blind most of the way, since your compasses and GPS instruments are ineffective," said Brannan.
"The men are well trained for that. The key to a successful high-altitude, low-opening infiltration jump is to exit at the correct grid-coordinate upwind and have everyone under canopy at relatively the same altitude."
"We'll put you out on a silver quarter, but it won't be no picnic."
"No," said Cleary solemnly. "I'm sure that in the first minute after we drop from the plane, we'll wish we were falling into a fiery hell instead."
Stafford checked the instrument panel again. "After you and your men finish pre-breathing, I'll decompress the cabin.
Immediately afterward, I'll pass on the 20- and 10-minute warnings to you and my crew. Then I'll notify you over the intercom when we're 6 minutes from the release point. At 2 minutes out, I'll lower the ramp.
Understood.
At 1 minute out, Stafford went on, I'm going to ring the alarm bell once. Then, when we're directly over the release point, I'll turn on the green light. At the airspeed we'll be flying, you'll have to get out quickly as a group.
Our intentions exactly.
Good luck to you, said Stafford, twisting in his pilot seat and shaking hands with the major.
Cleary smiled faintly.
Thanks for the ride.
Our pleasure, Stafford said genuinely. But I hope we don't have to do it again anytime soon.
Nor do I.
Cleary stood and straightened, left the cockpit, and walked aft into the aircraft's cavernous cargo bay. The 65 men seated inside were a serious-faced group, dogged and dead calm, considering the uncertain peril they were about to encounter. They were young. Their ages ranged from 20 to 24. There was no laughter or unproductive conversation, no grousing or complaining. To a man, they were absorbed in checking and rechecking their equipment. They were a composite of America's finest fighting men, hastily thrown together on the spur of the moment from special units nearest to Antarctica that were on counter-drug operations throughout South America. A team of Navy SEALs, members of the Army's elite Delta Force, and a Marine Force recon team. A combined band of secret warriors on a mission unlike any ever conceived. Once the alert had been given the Pentagon by the White House, the one thing they had in short supply was time. A larger Special Forces unit was on the way from the United States, but was not expected to reach Okuma Bay for another 3 hours, a time span that might prove too late and disastrous. Admiral Sandecker's warning was not received with enthusiasm by the President's top aides, nor the Armed Forces Chief of Staff. At first, none dared believe the incredible story. Only when Lauren Smith and other scientists added their weight to the plea for action was the President persuaded to order the Pentagon to send a special force to stop the rapidly approaching cataclysm. An air assault with missiles was quickly ruled out because of an utter lack of intelligence data. Nor could the White House and Pentagon be absolutely sure that they might not find themselves in hot water with the world for destroying an innocent plant and hundreds of employees. Nor could they be certain of the specific location for the command center for Earth's destruction. For all they knew, it could be hidden in an underground ice chamber miles from the facility. The Joint Chiefs decided that a manned assault offered the best chance of success, without an international outcry if they were wrong. The men were seated on their heavy rucksacks, wearing parachutes, and were engaged in completing Jumpmaster inspections. The rucksacks were full of survival gear and ammunition for the new Spartan Q-99 Eradicator, a 10-pound deadly killer weapon that integrated an automatic 12-gauge shotgun, a 5.56-millimeter automatic rifle with sniper scope, and a large-bore barrel in the center that fired small shrapnel-inflicting missiles that exploded with deadly results at the slightest impact. The spare magazines, shotgun shells, and shrapnel missiles weighed nearly 20 pounds and were carried in belly packs slung around their waists. The top flap of the belly pack held a navigation board, complete with a Silva marine compass and digital altimeter, both clearly visible to the jumper while gliding under his canopy. Captain Dan Sharpsburg led the Army's Delta Force, while Lieutenant Warren Garnett was in command of the Marine Recon Team. Lieutenant Miles Jacobs and his SEAL team, which had aided Numa on St. Paul Island, was also part of the assault force. The combined group was under the command of Cleary, a former Special Forces veteran, who was on leave with his wife enjoying the Kruger Game Park in South Africa, when he was whisked away on a minute's notice to take command of the elite makeshift assault unit. It had to be the first time in American military history that separate special units were merged to fight as one. For this mission, every man would be utilizing a new Ram Air parachute system for the first time, called the MT-1Z, or Zulu. With a 4-to-1 lift-to-drag ratio, the canopy could travel 4 meters horizontally for every meter descended, an advantage that did not go unappreciated among the three teams. Cleary scanned the two rows of men. The nearest officer, Dan Sharpsburg, tilted his head and grinned. A red-haired wit with a gross sense of humor, and an old friend, he was one of the few who actually looked forward to the suicidal plunge. Dan had been chasing airplanes for years, achieving the status of military freefall instructor at the U.S. Army's prestigious Special Forces Military Freefall School in Yuma, Arizona. When not off on a mission or training, Dan could be found skydiving with civilians for the fun of it. Cleary barely had time to glance at the service records of Jacobs and Garnett, but he knew they were the best of the best turned out by the Navy and Marines for Special Force missions. Though he was an old Army man, he well knew the SEALs and Marine recon teams were among the finest fighting men in the world. As he looked from face to face, he thought that if they survived the jump and glide to the target site, they then had the Wolf's security force to contend with. A well-armed and trained small army of mercenaries, he was told, many of whom had served the very same forces as the men on the plane. No, Cleary concluded, this would be no picnic. How soon? Sharpsburg asked tersely. Less than an hour, Cleary answered, moving down the line of men and alerting Jacobs and Garnett. Then he stood in the middle of the United Fighting Men and gave them final instructions. Satellite aerial photos were carried by everyone in a pocket of their thermal suits, to be studied once they had fallen into the clear and opened their canopies. Their target landing site was a large ice field just outside the mining facility, whose broken, uneven landscape offered them a small degree of protection when regrouping after the jump. The next part of the plan was the assault on the main engineering center of the facility, where it was hoped the doomsday controls were housed. Expert military minds judged that fewer casualties would occur if they landed and attacked from the outside rather than landing in the maze of buildings, antennas, machinery, and electrical equipment. Coordination was to take place once each unit was on the ground and assembled for the assault. Any who were injured upon landing would have to suffer the cold and be dealt with later, after the facility had been secured and any systems or equipment that were designed to separate the ice shelf destroyed. Satisfied that each man knew what was expected of him, Cleary moved to the rear of the cargo bay and donned his parachute and rucksack. Then he had one of Sharpsburg's men give him a complete jumpmaster inspection, with emphasis on his oxygen breathing equipment for the long fall. Finally, he silhouetted himself with his back to the closed cargo ramp in the floor and waved his hands to get the men's attention. From this point on, communication with the entire assault team would be conducted by hand and arm signals, which was standard operating procedure. The only voice communications until the jump would be between Cleary, Sharpsburg, Jacobs, Garnett, and Stafford in the cockpit. Once they exited the aircraft and were under canopy, each man could communicate with individual Motorola radios over secure frequencies. "Pilot, this is the Jumpmaster."
"I read you, Major," came back Stafford's voice. "Ready on the mark?"
"Jumpmaster checks complete. Oxygen pre-breathing is underway." Cleary took an empty seat and studied the men. So far it was going well, almost too well, he thought. This is the time when Murphy's Law came sneaking around, and Cleary wasn't about to allow Mr. Murphy any opportunities. He was pleased to see the men were fully alert and primed. They wore hoods under gray Gentex flight helmets to gain additional protection from the harsh sub-zero temperatures. Adidas Gale Force yellow lens goggles for fog and overcast were attached to the helmets, resting up and leaving the men's eyes clearly visible to Cleary and the oxygen technician so they could check for any signs of hypoxia. The heating units in their thermal suits were activated, and each man checked his buddy to make certain that all equipment was properly organized and in place.
Bungee cords and web straps were strategically laced around each man's clothing and equipment to prevent them from being torn away by the great burst of air expected upon their exit from the ramp. After they checked their radios to confirm that each was transmitting and receiving, Cleary stood up and moved near the closed ramp. Facing his assault force again, he saw that all the men were giving him their undivided attention. Once again, he motioned to the man nearest his left with a thumbs-up signal. In the cockpit, carefully studying his computerized course and the programmed target, Captain Stafford was concentrating his mind and soul on dropping the men waiting aft over the precise spot that would give them every chance of surviving. His primary concern was not to send them out 10 seconds too early or 5 seconds too late and scatter them all over the frozen landscape. He disengaged the automatic pilot and turned the controls over to Brannan so his perspective and timing would not be diverted. Stafford switched to the cockpit intercom and spoke through his oxygen mask to Brannan. "Deviate 1 degree and it will cost them." "I'll put them over the target," Brannan said self-assuredly. "But you have to put them on it." "No confidence in your aircraft commander's navigational abilities? Shame on you." "A 1,000 pardons, my captain." "That's better," Stafford said expansively. He switched to the cargo bay intercom. "Major Cleary, are you ready?"
"Roger," Cleary answered briefly.
"Crew, are you ready?" The crewmen, wearing harnesses attached to cargo tie-down rings and portable oxygen systems, were standing a few feet forward of the ramp on opposite sides.
"Sergeant Hendricks ready, Captain."
"Corporal Hokeen ready, sir."
20-minute warning, Major," Stafford announced. "Depressurizing cabin at this time." Hendricks and Hokeen moved cautiously close to the ramp, carefully guiding their harness anchor lines, following checklists and preparing for what was about to become one of the most unusual duties of their military careers. As the cabin decompressed, the men could feel the temperature drop, even within the protective confines of their electrically heated thermal jumpsuits. The air hissed from the cargo bay as it slowly equalized with the outside atmosphere. Time passed quickly, and then Stafford's voice came over the intercom.
"Major, 10-minute warning."
"Roger."
There was a pause, then Cleary asked sarcastically,
"Can you give us any more heat back here?"
"Didn't I tell you?" Stafford replied. "We need ice for cocktails after you leave."
For the next 2 minutes, Cleary went over the infiltration plan of the mining facility in his mind. They were combining the elements of a high-altitude, low-canopy opening jump with a high-altitude, high-canopy opening jump to keep detection to a minimum. The plan was for the team to free-fall to 25,000 feet, open their canopies, assemble in the air, and fly to the target landing zone. Sharpsburg's Delta Force would exit first, closely followed by Jacobs and his SEALs, and then by Garnett and his Marine recon team. Cleary would be the last man to jump, in order to have an overview of his men and be in the most advantageous position to give course corrections. Sharpsburg would be the mother hen, the term tagged to the lead jumper. All of the ducks in line would then follow. Where Sharpsburg went, so would they.
6 minutes to jump, came Stafford's voice, interrupting Cleary's thoughts.
Stafford's eyes were on the computer monitor, linked to a newly installed photo system that revealed the ground in astonishing detail through the clouds. Brannan handled the big aircraft as tenderly as if it were a child, his course rock steady on the line that traveled across the monitor, with a small circle depicting the jump target.
"Damn the orders," Stafford suddenly snorted. "Brannan."
"Sir?"
"At the 1 minute warning, cut our airspeed to 135 knots indicated. I'm going to give those guys every chance at surviving I can. When Sergeant Hendricks reports that the last man has jumped, ease the throttles to 200 knots.
"Won't the Wolf's ground radar pick up our reduction in speed?"
"Radio McMurdo station on an open frequency. Then say we're experiencing engine trouble. We'll have to reduce speed and arrive late."
Not a bad cover, Brannon conceded. If they're monitoring us on the ground, they'd have no reason not to buy the story.
Brannon went on his radio and announced the deception to anyone who was listening. Then he gestured at the numerals flashing on the computer monitor, indicating the approaching jump mark.
2 minutes coming up.
Stafford nodded.
Begin reducing speed very gradually. At 1 minute to drop, just after I ring the bell, cut the airspeed to 135.
Brannon flexed his fingers like a piano player and smiled.
I shall orchestrate the throttles like a concerto.
Stafford switched to the cargo bay intercom.
2 minutes, Major. Sergeant Hendricks, begin opening the ramp.
Ramp opening, came back Hendricks' steady voice.
Stafford turned to Brannon.
I'll take the controls. You handle the throttle so I can concentrate on timing the drop.
After monitoring the transmission, Cleary stood up and moved to the port side of the ramp, keeping his back turned to one side of the fuselage so he had a clear view of his men, the jump caution lights, and the ramp. He raised and extended his right arm in an arc, palm facing from his side to a perpendicular position. This was the command to stand up. The men rose from their seats and stood, checking their ripcords and equipment again, adjusting the heavy rucksacks they wore to the rear below their main parachute container. The huge ramp began to creep open, allowing a great rush of frigid air to sweep through the cargo bay. The next seconds passed with cruel sluggishness. In grim determination, they gripped the steel anchor-line cables with gloved hands for support against the immense whirlwind they expected when the ramp fully opened, and as guides as they moved to the edge of the ramp to execute their exit. Although they exchanged self-assured glances, it was as if they didn't see their buddies around them. No words were needed to describe what they would experience once the ramp opened, and they dove into air so cold it was unimaginable. In the cockpit, Stafford turned to Brannon.
I'll take the controls now so I can concentrate on timing. The throttles are yours.
Brannon raised both hands.
She's all yours, Cap.
Cap? Cap? Stafford repeated as if in pain. Can't you show me at least a smidgen of respect?
Then he switched the intercom aft.
1 minute warning, Major.
Cleary did not acknowledge. He didn't have to. The alarm bell rang once. He gave the next signal, right arm straight out to his side at shoulder level, palm up, then bent it at the elbow until his hand touched his Gentex helmet, giving the command to move to the rear, the men in front coming to a stop 3 feet from the ramp hinges. He lowered his goggles into place and silently began counting off the seconds until exit. Suddenly he sensed something out of place. The aircraft was noticeably slowing.
Ramp opened and locked, Captain, Hendricks informed Stafford.
The sergeant's voice took Cleary by surprise. He immediately realized that he had forgotten to disconnect his communications cord from the intercom jack. Cleary gave the men the hand and arm signal, indicating 15 seconds from exit. His eyes were fixed on the red caution light. The 65-man team was massed into a tightly compressed group, with Sharpsburg now perched inches from the edge of the ramp. Simultaneously, as the crimson caution light blinked off and the jump light flashed a vivid green, Cleary pointed to the open ramp. As if jolted by a shock of electricity, Lieutenant Sharpsburg dove from the aircraft, soaring off into cloud-shrouded nothingness. With his arms and legs spread, he was swept out of sight as swiftly as if he'd been jerked by a giant spring. His team was no more than a few feet behind, as they were also swallowed up in the clouds, followed swiftly by Jacobs and his SEAL team. Then came Garnett and his Marines. As the last Marine stepped off the ramp edge, Cleary leaped and was gone. For a long moment, Hendricks and Hokeen stood and stared into the white oblivion, unable to believe what they had just witnessed. Almost as if mesmerized, Hendricks spoke into the intercom on his oxygen mask.
Captain, they're gone.
Brannon lost no time in easing the throttles forward until the airspeed instruments read 200 knots, half the C-17's cruising speed. The cargo door was closed and the oxygen system in the cargo bay replenished. Stafford's next act of business was to switch to a secure frequency and radio the U.S. South Atlantic Command headquarters to report that the jump went as scheduled. Then he turned to Brannon.
"I hope they make it," he said quietly. "If they do, it will be because you sent them out into a blast of air a good 250 miles an hour less in strength than our normal cruising speed."
"I hope to God I didn't give them away," said Stafford, without remorse. "But it seemed certain death to subject them to such an explosive gust."
"You won't get an argument from me," Brannon said somberly.
Stafford sighed heavily as he re-engaged the automatic pilot.
"Not our responsibility any longer. We dropped them right on a dime."
Then he paused, staring into the ominous white clouds that whipped past the windshield and obscured all view.
"I pray they all get down safely."
Brannon looked at him askance.
"I didn't know you were a praying man."
"Only during traumatic times." "They'll make it down," said Brannon with a sense of optimism. "It's after they hit the ground that hell could break loose."
Stafford shook his head. "I wouldn't want to go up against those guys that just jumped. I'll bet their attack will be a walk in the park."
Stafford had no idea how dead wrong he was. The radar operator in the security building headquarters next to the control center picked up a phone as he studied the line sweep around his radar screen.
"Mr. Wolf, do you have a moment?"
A few minutes later, Hugo Wolf walked briskly into the small, darkened room filled with electronic units.
"Yes, what is it?"
"Sir, the American supply aircraft suddenly reduced its speed."
"Yes, I'm aware of that. Our radio intercepted a message from them saying they were having engine trouble."
"Do you think it might be a ruse?"
"Has it strayed from its normal flight path?" asked Hugo.
The radar operator shook his head.
"No, sir, the plane is 10 miles out."
"You see nothing else on the screen?"
"Only the usual interference during and immediately after an ice storm."
Hugo put a hand on the operator's shoulder.
"Follow her course to make sure she doesn't double back, and keep a sharp eye for a hostile intrusion from the sea or air."
"And behind us, sir?"
"Now who do you think would have the powers to cross the mountains or trek over the ice shelf in the middle of an ice storm?"
The operator shrugged.
"No one. Certainly no one who is human."
Hugo grinned.
"Exactly."
Air Force General Jeffrey Coburn laid the phone back in its receiver and looked across the long table in the war room deep beneath the Pentagon.
"Mr. President, Major Cleary and his unified command have exited the aircraft."
The Joint Chiefs and their aides were seated in a theater-like section of a long room whose massive walls were covered with huge monitors and screens showing scenes of Army bases, Navy ships, and Air Force fields around the globe. The current status of ships at sea and military aircraft in the air were constantly monitored, especially the big transports carrying the hastily assembled special forces from the United States. One huge screen that lay against the far wall held a montage of telephoto images taken of the Destiny Enterprises mining facility at Okuma Bay. The photos in the montage were not from an overhead view, but appeared to be pieced together and conceptualized after being shot from an aircraft several miles off to one side of the facility. There were no overhead images because the military had no spy reconnaissance satellites orbiting over the South Pole. The only direct radio contact with Cleary's assault force came from a civilian communication satellite used by United States ice research stations on the Ross Ice Shelf that was linked to the Pentagon. Another screen revealed President Dean Cooper Wallace, 6 members of his cabinet, and a team of his close advisors, who were seated around a table in the secure room deep beneath the White House.
The directors of the CIA and FBI, including Ron Little and Ken Helm, were also present on a direct link with the War Room, along with Congresswoman Lauren Smith, who had been invited because of her intimate knowledge of Destiny Enterprises. While they acted as advisors to the president on what had been given the codename Apocalypse Project, Admiral Sandecker sat with the Joint Chiefs at the Pentagon and acted as consultant on their end.
"What is the countdown, General?" asked the president.
1 hour and 42 minutes, sir," General Amos South, head of the Joint Chiefs, answered. "That is the time our scientists tell us when tidal currents are at their height to separate the ice shelf and carry it out to sea."
"Just how accurate is this intelligence?"
"You might say it comes from the horse's mouth," Lauren replied. "The timetable was revealed by Carl Wolf himself and was confirmed by the nation's top glaciologists and experts on nanotechnology."
"Since Admiral Sandecker's people penetrated Wolf's organization," explained Ron Little, "we have accumulated considerably more intelligence on what the Wolfs call the Valhalla Project. It all adds up to them doing exactly what they threaten, cutting off the Ross ice shelf and upsetting Earth's rotational balance in order to cause a polar shift,
triggering a cataclysm of unimaginable destruction," added Lauren.
"We've come to the same conclusion at the FBI," said Helm, backing up Little.
"We've asked experts in the field of nanotechnology to study the facts, and all agree. The Wolfs have the scientific and engineering capability to execute such an unthinkable act." The president stared into the monitor at General South.
"I still say send in a missile and stop this insanity before it can get off the ground."
"Only as a last resort, Mr. President. The Joint Chiefs and I strongly agree that it is too risky."
Admiral Morton Eldridge, Chief of the Navy, entered the discussion.
"One of our aircraft, equipped with radar intercept systems, has arrived on site. They've already reported that the Wolf mining facility has superior radar equipment that could detect an incoming missile from an aircraft or nearby submarine with a warning time of 3 minutes. That's more than enough time to alert and panic them into throwing the doomsday switch early, a situation that may or may not break off the ice shelf. Again, a risk that is a poor gamble at best."
"If, as you say," said Wallace, "their radar equipment is rated as superior, haven't they already been alerted by your aircraft and the signals it sends out?"
Admiral Eldridge and General Coburn exchanged bemused glances before Eldridge replied.
"Because it is highly classified, it is known only by a select few that our new radar warning systems are virtually undetectable. Our radar interception aircraft is below the horizon."
"We can bend our signals to read theirs, but they cannot find or read ours."
"Should our ground force be unable to penetrate the Wolf security defenses," said South, "then, of course, as a last resort, we'll send in a missile from our nuclear attack sub Tucson."
"She's already on station in the Antarctic?" asked Wallace incredulously.
"Yes, sir," answered Eldridge. "A fortunate coincidence. She was on an ice data gathering patrol when she successfully destroyed the Wolf's U-boat that was firing on the NUMA research ship Polar Storm. Admiral Sandecker alerted me in time to send her to Okuma Bay before the final countdown."
"What about aircraft?"
2 stealth bombers are in the air and will begin a holding pattern 90 miles from the facility in another hour and 10 minutes," answered Coburn.
"So we're covered from air and sea," said Wallace.
"That is correct," General South acknowledged.
"How soon before Major Cleary and his force begin their assault?"
South glanced up at a huge digital clock on one wall.
"Depending on wind and overcast conditions, they should be gliding toward their target and landing in a few minutes."
"Will we receive a blow-by-blow account of the assault?"
"We have a direct link to Major Cleary's ground communications through the satellite that's servicing our ice stations at the Pole and McMurdo Sound.
But since he and his men will be extremely busy for the next hour, and possibly coming under hostile fire, we do not think it wise to interfere or interrupt their field communications."
"Then we have nothing to do but wait and listen," Wallace spoke mechanically.
Silence greeted his words. No one in either war room offered him a reply. After a long moment, he murmured, "God, how did we ever get in this mess?"